Good afternoon, everybody. This is Patrick Milliken from the Poison Pen Bookstore, and it is a real privilege and an honor to be talking with Mark Bowden. Bowden or Bowden?
Bowden.
Bowden. Mark Bowden. I guess I should have cleared that up before I started the program. Mark Bowden.
I answered it.
legendary journalist. Let me give you the formal introduction. Mark Bowden is the author of 13 books, including the number one New York Times bestseller, Black Hawk Down, Killing Pablo, Way, 1968, and The Last Stone. He reported at the Philadelphia Inquirer for 20 years and now writes for The Atlantic and other magazines. His new book is The Case of the Vanishing Blonde and Other True Crime Stories. These are six exquisitely written true crime pieces that span a 40-year period and a real crucial period in criminal investigation, and we'll get into that. But Mark, it's really great to have you with me today. Thanks for taking time out of your day to join me.
Sure, what a pleasure.
Yeah. I guess before we kind of get into this, what I wanted to ask you as kind of an opener is, you know, you've been a veteran reporter for how many years? 45 at least, right?
A reporter for a long time, a veteran for like the last 10 or 15 years.
And in that, you know, as I mentioned, you know, you've written on an amazing variety of different topics, you know. Do you consider yourself first and foremost a reporter?
Yes. Yep, without a doubt.
Without a doubt. And, you know, these last couple of books, you know, The Case of the Vanishing Blonde, as I alluded in the introduction, these pieces span a 40-year period, roughly 40-year period. And, you know, as I said, the techniques of criminal investigation have completely changed the game. And also in the writing of true crime. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. In fact, I addressed this, as you know, Patrick, in the introduction.
Yeah.
You know, when I started working as a reporter 40 years ago or so, it was very rare to have any solid documentary evidence of a scene. The thing you're always looking for as a writer are scenes that you can bring to life with characters and action and dialogue. And that's always a very hard challenge with nonfiction, because you had to, in the past, almost exclusively rely on people's memories, and people's memories are iffy. Back in the day, I mean, if you had a photograph of something that you were writing about, it was very valuable to you because you could use it to accurately describe, you know, the way something looked. Today, there's video of everything and audio. So as you go forward in these progressions of stories in this collection, you'll see in recent years, I've been dealing with stories where I have such an ample amount of documentary evidence, be it video or audio, that it's a more of an editing challenge than anything else to try to figure out, you know, how much of it to use, how to pry a story out of this mass of detail.
You know, it's funny, I'm a big true crime reader and a fan for a long time. And one of the things that annoyed me was this tendency for some writers to, you know, obviously they didn't have enough material to work with. So you'd get these real awkward scenes like, yeah, Joe must have been thinking about his upcoming summer vacation when he was, you know, those kind of really awkward kind of scenes.
I follow those tricks, yeah.
Yeah. Now, one of the things in the introduction I wanted to ask you about was, you mentioned a particular editor, for the Philadelphia Inquirer who was a big fan of, he liked a good lurid tale. Can you talk about that a little bit in some of your earlier pieces?
Yeah. You know, there's this wonderful guy, he's now deceased. His name is Ron Patel, big, tall, dark haired, handsome guy who was our Sunday editor. The Sunday editor at a big newspaper basically controlled what stories went on the front page. And so I was fortunate, as you know, with a number of my colleagues, that Ron was someone who loved a lurid monastery. He called them dirt balls. And so we actually, over the years, young reporters who were working there with me, called up in part, we would compete throughout the week, pulling stories off the police blotter and reporting them and trying to develop them so that Ron would put them in the Sunday paper. And he would strip them across the top of the masthead. So it was like the prime display for a story. And then it would jump inside to a big inside page. So we fought like crazy to get what we called the dirt ball strip.
And so I think the earliest piece that appears in the in this book that kind of leads off the book is a story about kind of campus rape that goes back to 1983. And it was quite an important story, really, groundbreaker, really. Can you talk a little bit about that story?
Yeah, I mean, this was this flared up at the University of Pennsylvania, which is in Philadelphia. A young woman went to a fraternity party, tripping on acid and drunk, and was victimized by a whole bunch of the fraternity brothers, and who thought nothing of it. I mean, they just thought this was, you know, what a frat party was supposed to be. But there was sort of an emerging feminist consciousness at Penn that made an issue of this. And it was something that was controversial even then in the newsroom of the Inquirer. I pursued this story, and I have to give credit. I had an editor there, Carolyn White, who was really determined to develop this story, despite the fact that most of the editors at the newspaper, who were men, were shrugging their shoulders. Like, what's the big deal? I mean, what did this girl expect? She went to this party drunk. I mean, of course these guys are going to take advantage of her. So in that sense, and I give Carolyn credit for it, she recognized that this was something horrible and worth reporting and writing about. And because I was young and athletic and I kind of fit the frat guy, you know, image, I could walk onto campus and into the frat house and talk to these frat brothers. And they just assumed, talking to me, that I would, of course, see things their way. And it ended up being, you know, quite an interesting tale. And one that I think, you know, viewed but through today's perspective is maybe a little less surprising, but back then it was remarkable.
And then you have these three, I'm just going to kind of go all over the place with the book. We can kind of touch on all the pieces, but you have these three stories featuring this with Ken Brennan. Is that the correct name? This really incredible figure in a sort of old school, kind of like a modern day Sam Spade kind of character. Really, really amazing. And the title piece in the book, really, we talked about technology and cameras and surveillance video play an immensely important role in this guy's investigation. Can you talk a little bit about Brennan and then about the three different pieces?
Sure. You know, I have to begin, Patrick, by saying that, you know, I'm a fan of Truman Capote's, and he wrote this great story years after he wrote In Cold Blood called Hand-Carved Coffins. And it was a serial murder story. And there's actually some question about its authenticity, the authenticity of the reporting at this point, but it's a great read. But it was all about Alvin Dewey, who was the Kansas State Police investigator who solved the In Cold Blood story. So clearly, and I remember reading this years ago and thinking, what a great idea. Truman Capote stayed friends with this detective, because detectives have amazing stories if they're really good ones. So I was very lucky, gosh, it's about 15 years ago now, that this guy Ken Brennan called me up and he said, you know, I've got this great story. And most of the time when people call me and tell me they have a great story, what they want is for me to co-author something with them, or they think I'm going to pay them for a story, or and I have to disabuse them of that, and they usually go away.
Right.
And in Ken's case, he says, I don't care about any of that. I've got a great story. I want to tell you. So I met him. He told me this story that, you know, how he solved the case of the vanishing blonde, as Vanity Fair called it. And I went out and reported it on my own. And the story that Ken gave me completely checked out. And it turned out to be, you know, one of the most widely read, successful stories I ever wrote. Then I have to say, and I'll shut up after a minute, but no. A year or two later, Ken called again, and he was in Philadelphia, where I live. And he said, why don't you come out and meet me for lunch? So I did. And on the way to the lunch, I was thinking, you know what? I bet you Ken thinks he has another story that I'm going to write, and I'm going to have to let him down easy because it can't possibly be as good as the case of the Vanishing Blonde. So I go to lunch, and he tells me the story, what is now called the body in room 348.
Right.
And about halfway through the lunch, I just leaned back and said, you got me again, Ken. This is just such a great story. So our relationship has continued.
Now, what kind of a guy is he, in person? And what's his personality like? Is he kind of a classic old school sort of gruff guy? I mean, you get an image of him when you read the stories.
Yeah, he's really smart, and he hides it well. He presents himself as sort of like an earthy cop from Long Island, and he speaks with a lot of profanity, and you're not, at least initially, impressed with much beyond that he's really tough and he's very much a straight shooter. But then when you get into the work that he does and you go meet the people who he has worked with and begin learning how he puts together these investigations, you can't help but marvel at what skill he has in doing this, not just with, the sort of forensic arts of crime procedurals, but also people skills. People love Ken. I love Ken. I mean, he makes friends wherever he goes. People trust him. Getting cops who've investigated a case without any success for years to suddenly throw in with this guy who shows up, who speaks with this thick New York accent, and letting him basically rework their case, that's talent. That's not an easy thing to do. And I have yet to meet anyone who has worked with Ken on one of these stories who doesn't just shake their heads and say the guy is just incredible.
There are other stories and other journalists he's worked with?
No, not to my knowledge.
Oh.
So far.
It was interesting. I had the pleasure of speaking with Michael Connelly, great crime novelist of our day. And his latest book, he kind of returns to a reporter character that he wrote several books about. One was called The Poet. You may have read a couple of them. But we got into a really interesting discussion about the difference between the reporter's role and the detective's role, and the kind of the overlap between those two different pursuits. Not to just hit you cold with that, but do you have any comments, or do you see a real through line there?
Without a doubt. I mean, I've been working for many years and have written many, many crime stories, worked with a lot of cops and investigators, and there are real parallels. The really good cops are interested in a lot of the same things that I am as a writer. But I think the bottom line is, investigators and the police are looking to figure out what happened and assign blame. And the blame part of it is not my role. My role is simply to understand what happened. And where our paths diverge often is when I know who is the person who did something, like in my book, The Last Stone, Lloyd Welsh, when you know this is the culprit, that's when my interest starts. I want to understand, to me, that's what's fascinating. I want to understand how this person did this, why they did it, what were the circumstances that led to this happening? And this is all beyond the purview of criminal justice. This is more in the realm of Michael Connelly writing fiction or me writing these nonfiction stories. I basically just want to understand.
Well, you make the point, you know, Brennan, or as we see when we read these pieces, although he's obviously been hired by a client to solve a case, he makes it very clear that his primary motivation is to follow the case. His devotion is to the case first, and finding right. the truth wherever that happens to lead, even if it's an inconvenient truth, you know.
Right.
And
it is.
And I love that bit. I'll blow the line, but the quote, the detective doesn't work the case so much as the case works the detective. I kind of love that whole sort of maybe slightly romanticized riff, but.
But Penn does have a tremendous amount of integrity. And, you know, he also is at a point in his life where he's not doing it for the money anymore.
Yep.
He's doing these things because he loves to do it, because he's good at it. And, you know, and he's hired, you know, in the case of the woman who was abandoned and nearly killed in Florida, the case of the Vanishing Blonde, he was hired by the insurance company for the hotel. And they were hoping that he would just say she was a prostitute and that would free them of any liability for what happened to her. And that's not at all what happened. And, you know, Ken had to really work with them to get them to let him continue to pay his expenses, to continue to work the case, when he realized that this was actually a far more serious crime. And he appealed to their social conscience. He said, you know, we've got a guy who I think is going around raping women all over the country, and we have a chance to catch him. And, you know, how can we not try to get this guy? And he did. I mean, the man he caught is in the Supermax out in Colorado for the rest of his days.
Well, it's funny too, because if I'm remembering correctly, the actual cop that was assigned to the case took Ken's advice and went and sought the guy out. And then he said, no, this isn't the guy.
Ken tells him, you're wrong.
You're That's wrong. That is the guy. And we're not giving away any spoilers here, but I'm just going to hold up the book. I always forget the commercial plug, Mark. Mr. Bowden very kindly signed a whole batch of these copies, and we still have some left, although they're going fast. So pick up a copy while we still have some signed ones.
You still have people coming in the store?
We don't, no, but we're at the moment we kind of closed down to the store, at least to browsers and things. We're still doing a pretty robust mail order business, and we have an amazing customer base, incredibly loyal, so we're hustling. You know, we're doing a lot of these programs, and I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today. Without giving too much away, what do you see as the difference between one of these shorter magazine length pieces and a case like The Last Stone that has such a huge, has the potential to be, you know, fleshed out into a big book length narrative?
Yeah. Well, it depends on the material. I mean, I think a story should be no longer than it needs to be. And so very often, in fact, most often, when I begin working on something, I'm thinking in terms of a long magazine piece. And I'm fortunate with The Atlantic and Vanity Fair to have editors who will give me room, you know, to really unfold a story. But it's rare, to be honest, that these kinds of stories, to me anyway, open up doors and doors and doors the way stories do that become books. And when that happens, you know, I follow it. I'm fortunate that, again, I'm not writing to make a living anymore. I'm doing this because I don't have anything else to do, and I don't know how to do anything else as well as I can do this. So it's fun for me. But, you know, it's the rare book. It's the rare story, rather, that cries out to be told at book length.
Now, you mentioned The Last Stone, which is, I think, just out in paperback now. And tell me a little bit about that book. I mean, you as a Cub reporter, I understand you wrote some of the original pieces of this 1975. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah, two little girls disappeared from a mall in suburban Washington, and I was a young reporter in Baltimore, and they sent me down, and for 2 weeks, I wrote daily stories as the county kind of turned itself inside out, trying to find these little girls, and I got to know their family, and I got to know the detectives who were working on it, and nothing came of it. I mean, they never found any trace of these girls. So then, you know, that was something that haunted me, because, you know, these were two beautiful little girls, 9 and 11, just vanished, and I couldn't, no one had a clue, you know, what happened. So over the years, I mean, I married and had children of my own, you know, I have granddaughters, you know, this kind of thing, you know, just stays with you. So when I read, actually it was my sister, who lives just outside of Baltimore, sent me a link to a story in the Washington Post saying that they had named a person of interest in this old case. And so I was actually working on a mammoth project way 1968. I was 6 years into writing this book. And so I just took a break and called down to the Montgomery County, Maryland police headquarters and said, you know, I'm really curious to know what you've got on this, because I remember this case. And they knew who I was. And so they said, well, come on down. I'll introduce you to the detectives. And that's how that story opened up. They ended up, you know, finding the person who kidnapped these two little girls. And that book tells the story of how they unraveled with great difficulty, at least a heavy measure of truth.
Wow. That must have been quite an experience, kind of an emotional experience for you, too, to write that book.
Well, it was. I mean, I think when you get to my age, I'll be 69 in a couple of weeks, and you've been doing this for as long as I have, one of the advantages that you have is that you have a perspective that goes back decades. And so, I mean, this is a story, I have roots in this story. And so for me not to exploit the opportunity to use what I knew and to build on that, and then, you know, to a very minor degree, write about my own connection to it and why it affected me in the way that it did, was just something that I couldn't pass up.
Sure. Now, you mentioned, this is probably a good time to get into it a little bit. You mentioned Huey 1968, you know, the year of the Tet Offensive and the turning point of the war. Right. You know, I always thought before I read the book, your book, that Michael Herr's Dispatches was the best thing I'd ever read about the Vietnam War. And I haven't by any means read them all, but I can't tell you how much I admire what you did with that book, Way 1968.
Thanks. I'm proud of it too.
Yeah.
Michael Herr was a special case. I mean, he was an absolutely brilliant writer and reporter, and, you know, his ability to observe and experience, and he was right in the middle of all that action. I mean, that is a classic of American war literature, and, you know, it's brilliant. It is, to be honest, not the most authentic piece of journalism that you're going to find, but, you know,
but
I might try a little of my chops in journalism to write the way that Michael Herr writes.
But the atmosphere that he is able to capture, you know, it's just...
No, in fact, you know, not just capture, but, you know, when you do it well, as he did, your work begins to define people's understanding and memory of a, you know, critically important moment in modern history. And I think any nonfiction writer who makes an indelible stamp like that, that he actually shapes the popular consciousness about an important event in modern times, that's about the height of achievement, as far as I'm concerned, for journalism and nonfiction writing. So Herr is a hard bar to leap.
Were there some...
I have to say that, you know, in keeping with this idea that having been at this for a long time, you know, I really only choose to write about things now that connect with me personally.
Yeah.
And Vietnam was a transformative and important period of my life. So this was a chance for me, without writing about myself directly, but for me to go back to this really critical period of my life and use the tools that I have today to investigate for myself. You know, I didn't know enough, frankly, about the Battle of Hue or the war in Vietnam to have a well-informed, strong opinion. But this book gave me the opportunity to dig in and really wrestle with what was happening and why and how I felt about it.
How long did it take you overall to write it?
That was about a six-year project.
Wow. Now, here, I guess we're going to get into some kind of deep material here, which is, you know, a lot of people have made the comparison between, you know, kind of the unrest that was happening in 68 and what's going on today. And, you know, you see right now, you see this time that we're in where, you know, investigative journalists are being targeted, being discredited. You know, what's your take? I mean, that's a huge question, but, you know, it seems to me that it's more important than ever to have investigative journalists, and the role of the reporter is immensely crucial to our survival, really, as a republic.
I couldn't agree more, and it's a very distressing period because so much of journalism has been discredited because of this blending of political advocacy and reporting. I mean, I taught for a number of years at the University of Delaware. I had very bright, ambitious young journalism students who honestly did not know the difference between activism and journalism. And I would have to tell them, you know, when you are working on a story as a journalist, you're not trying to sell the reader an idea or a candidate or a party line. You're trying to tell them something that they don't know. You're trying to understand. And so, of course, none of us is capable of being completely objective, but the standard or the goal as a journalist has always been for me to approach a story with an open mind and to let the story inform my understanding, to let my reporting shape the story that I tell, not some agenda that I have. And, you know, today, even solid, and there's a lot of it, tremendously good, honest reporting is tainted by the growth of propaganda in the marketplace of ideas. And we have whole television networks who are devoted to propaganda. And, you know, they label themselves journalists, but they're not doing the work that I consider to be journalism. So, and I feel so fortunate personally, you know, that I'm old enough that I grew up at a time and came up in journalism at a time when the values that I cherished were nurtured and guarded. And I fear that it's harder and harder for readers to know when they're reading the work of an honest reporter or when they're being manipulated.
Yeah, it increasingly becomes blurred, the difference between what is essentially the op-ed, you know, op-ed mm-hmm. news and just the facts, ma'am, type of reporting. And
well, you know, it doesn't even have to be, Patrick, just the facts. I mean, when I write a story, it's not just the facts. I'm making the most of the material that I have. But the bottom line is, I'm not doing that for any reason other than as an honest individual trying his best to understand how and why something happened the way it did. And I couldn't care less, you know, what political party you belong to, or I have no agenda beyond any story that I write. My only agenda is I want to be able to say to myself, I get it. I understand why this happened the way it did.
Yeah, it seems like we're really being strangled by this agenda-driven media.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because I mean, Fox...
There's more of that than anything else, and that's just because it sells. It's cheap and easy.
Right.
You know, a lot easier to stick four pundits in a studio and have them sitting there pontificating about something that some actual reporter went out and recovered and reported on, You know, that doesn't cost any money and it doesn't cost any time or effort. And yet that accounts for about 99% of what passes for journalism today.
Yeah, you get, you know, it's like Fox and MSNBC become essentially the same thing.
I won't do any of them. I won't go. I used to years ago before I wised up. I've been on all those shows, and now I won't do any of them because I just don't want to lend whatever shred of credibility I have to these great propaganda engines.
I love that. I think it was, I became a real fan of the A.J. Liebling, you know, and wasn't it his line that was, you know, the role of the journalist or the reporter is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable or something like that.
So that's exactly right. Yeah. No, he's got some wonderful stories. He has a book, The Case of the Scattered Dutchman. I strongly recommend it if you've never read it.
Well, there was a guy who did, you know, not unlike yourself, he did a lot of World War II, you know, wartime reporting, you know, and then he did these, just these wonderful, odd pieces, like the Telephone Booth Indian. Do you know that one?
I don't know that one.
He reported about this one payphone in, I think it was a rooming house that had just this amazing cross-section of criminal activity going through it at all time. And then he wrote, you know, this wonderful boxing story. I can't remember what it was, but like you, he did it all.
No, I mean, he's a great example to us all. Yeah. And a wonderful writer and a real clever writer and someone with a wonderful sense of humor and somebody who actually went out and did his own reporting, which is, you know, something we value always.
Were there other, you know, classic reporters that have been inspirational to you?
Oh, sure. You know, George Orwell, when I was in college, I read a lot of his work. John Hersey is a writer who is, you know, much forgotten today, but his books, you know, Hiroshima is a classic, and Belle Ferragano, his fiction and nonfiction, when I was a young reporter, really inspired me and showed, you know, the kind of creative writing that you can do if you do enough reporting. You know, I loved a lot of what Norman Mailer was writing. I loved, and you know, the the Armies of the Night and Truman Capote's In Cold Blood and do you remember Tommy Thompson's Blood and Money, you know, that great Texas murder story? You know, these were writers who made me realize that you could write something on the level of really fine fiction with nonfiction. Tom Wolfe, another, became a friend. Gay Talese, I mean, these were my heroes, and I've been lucky in my life, you know, to get to know these folks and be friends with them.
Did you? I mean, this is a digression a little bit, but did you happen to see that documentary about Gay Talese and that very odd voyeur case?
Voyeur Patel.
Yeah, that was wild.
It was wild, but you know, again, I mean, Gay is at that point in his life like me. He's a little older than I am, but he's going back to stories that, and in fact, that was a story that he covered for years and then never wrote, you know, and so he came back to it many years later. So.
Right.
These are all, you take your inspirations where you find them.
Right. Well, as we're talking, I'm just going to bring up and see if we have any questions from our audience. But I also wanted to ask you a little bit about, I mean, the obvious question, which is, when are we going to see a Mark Bowden crime novel?
You know, I don't know. You know, I'm actually trying to write fiction, and it's hard for me because I've written screenplays, which are fictional, but I've never written a novel. And I'm actually working on something I have been for a number of years that is an historical novel going back to the 18th century. And it's an amazingly difficult challenge for me. I'm a pretty fast writer. Usually if I've reported a story thoroughly, the writing part of it to me is the fun and easy part. Not that it's that easy, but it's not the hardest part for me. And it usually emerges fairly smoothly. I've been writing this novel in fits and starts for the last 7 or 8 years. and I never feel like I'm really getting there. So who knows, you know, whether I'll finish that or not, but that's a project.
Yeah, you mentioned a little bit in the introduction to this new book about you know, writing, so I can get the quote, something about writing fiction or writing nonfiction that has the flow and the pacing of a novel. And that's something that a lot of people try to accomplish. I'm sure it's a lot harder than it appears. I think they call it narrative nonfiction.
Sure. And of course, you know, I often have people say to me, at what point did you make things up? And I tell them, you know, I'm not allowed to make anything up. I'm writing nonfiction. And so I think, you know, it comes back. I was very lucky that I had all those years working as a reporter at a really fine newspaper, that I developed reporting skills and also the understanding that you can't write with the kind of detail that you need to really tell a compelling story if you haven't done just an extraordinary amount of reporting. I mean, I used to go, for instance, if I was writing a scene about something that happened in Philadelphia, I would have to go to the hotel room where that happened and get them to let me in so that I could look around the hotel room. So that if I said that the carpeting was beige, I mean, it was true. I saw the carpeting. These are skills that are not innate. I mean, you learn them and you get better at them as time goes by. I have to say it's become easier because of the existence of all this audio and video. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just extraordinary how close to reality you can get when you have that kind of material.
Sure. Well, you know, a lot of people became aware of your work somewhat late in the game with the film version of Black Hawk Down, which was, I'm sure, an amazing bit of good fortune in your career. How was that whole experience? Were you happy with the film? How involved were you?
It was like the greatest experience of my professional life, to be honest, Patrick. You know, the book itself was just an extraordinary experience for me. One of these stories that doors just kept opening, material just kept coming my way. People who I never dreamed would talk to me. The level of documentation for that battle that I wrote about was beyond anything that any writer, frankly, has ever had to work with. And again, in part because it was videotaped, you know, from helicopters overhead. So imagine writing a story about the Alamo when you can watch it. And that's what I had when I wrote Black Hawk Down. And then, you know, beyond that extraordinary experience of reporting and writing, then comes Hollywood. And I've been involved with Hollywood now for many, many years, so I know how extraordinary it is that somebody like Jerry Bruckheimer buys the rights to your story, and then within a year or two, Ridley Scott is directing it, and you're on the ground in Morocco shooting these scenes with the cast literally of thousands, making this extraordinary film. It was just...
It's probably surreal.
Surreal. I mean, you had to pinch yourself. And in fact, everybody involved felt that way. I mean, all the executive producer, I remember Mike Stenson, who was the president of Jerry Bruckheimer Films, a great guy. And, you know, he and I are standing out there in Rabat in Morocco, and he's just saying, Mark, this just doesn't happen. You know, this is just one of these things that never happens. So it was wonderful. I was very involved. I wrote the first draft of that screenplay. I was involved in choosing locations. I was involved with recruiting soldiers who fought in the battle to work as advisors. I was on the set in Morocco while they shot it. I worked on post-production. I wrote scenes that added dialogue to what they'd already shot in Morocco. I sat with Pietro Scalia, who won an Academy Award for his film editing, and Ridley Scott as they put that movie together. I went to the Academy Awards ceremony. I watched some friends pick up awards. I traveled all over the world on private jets at big premieres in London and Madrid and Rome and Paris, all over the world. I mean, when I came home, I remember pulling the garbage can up the driveway and thinking that my carriage and turned back into a pumpkin.
What a remarkable experience.
Yes. I mean, the most fun you can have without getting arrested, I think.
Now, will we see a Way 1968 film adaptation?
I sure hope so. You know, Michael Mann, who's a wonderful producer and director, bought the rights and has developed an 8-part, 9-part television miniseries for FX. But they balked at the price tag. And I think they were just purchased. I can't follow all these maneuvers in Hollywood, but FX was purchased by somebody else. And so right now it's in limbo, and it's going to take somebody who's willing to finance, you know, a big project. The man, who is a great guy and a brilliant filmmaker, is really determined to make it, so I'm rooting for him.
Wow, wouldn't that be great?
Wouldn't it be?
That would be amazing.
Yeah.
Before I kind of let you go, let's talk a little bit about some of the other material in the new book we can touch upon. We mentioned the stories with Ken Brennan. There are a couple of other really extraordinary pieces. One about this female cop who kind of goes very, very deep underground into the sleazy dark web world, baiting, you know, sexual predators. And can you talk a little bit about that story?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know this world existed, I'm happy to say. But, you know, there's people who go online to sort of satisfy, you know, erotic fantasies, and they get involved in these really grotesque chat groups. And one area of this kind of activity involves child molestation and child pornography. And so the detective's job is to sort of troll these worlds and try to snare people who express interest in acting on their desires. And so the story is about her catching this guy and actually luring him out and arresting him. And to me, what's fascinating about that story, apart from the whole milieu, which is just bizarre, is the question of entrapment. I think without question, that as well-intentioned as she is, this detective, I think she crossed the line. She lured out a troubled individual who would have probably never harmed anyone and basically ruined his life because he had, you know, really peculiar fantasies and a profound lack of judgment. But, you know, it's just one of these modern stories that would never have happened, you know, 20 years ago even, or 30 years ago. And that's one of the reasons why it fascinated me.
Yeah, it's funny as a reader. You know, you're aware that these strata of society, maybe not even calling it society is a good idea, but these strata of criminal activity, you know, they exist somewhere. And it's, for instance, have you ever investigated anything having to do with snuff films or that kind of thing?
Never have investigated, but I remember actually hearing about it many years ago. In fact, that was one of the theories that people had about what happened to the Lyons sisters, the two little girls who disappeared. I don't think there's any truth to that. But yeah, I've heard about that. It's just perfectly horrible to think about.
Yeah. And then also, maybe you could talk a little bit about the Stephanie Lazarus case. Mm-hmm. Who will police the police?
I know. Well, you know, well, that's just an amazing story of a 25-year-old murder case. Young woman, young bride, was murdered, found murdered in her apartment, and the LAPD came up with nothing for years and years and years until they because the murder rates had been so low during that period in the like early teens of the 21st century. A lot of these detectives were just handed cold cases and told, you know, to reopen them and go back and look at them. And they found, because back when this happened, there was no such thing as DNA analysis. They found some DNA from the perpetrator and it led them right back to their own police department. And the woman who they ultimately convicted of this murder was Stephanie Lazarus, who was a distinguished LAPD detective who years earlier had gotten in a jealous rage and gone off and murdered her ex-boyfriend's wife. One of the things that I love about that story is, again, in this age where everything is on videotape, when they figured out that it was Stephanie Lazarus who had done this, they helped the detectives who were reworking this case, invited her down to interview her on the pretense that they were going to ask for her help for some case that they were working on. It was only in the course of this interview that they gradually revealed to her that they were investigating her and that they suspected her. And so the whole story, the way I've written it, is constructed around that interview session where Stephanie walks in thinking it's one thing and ends up leaving in handcuffs. And it is just if I was a screenwriter, I couldn't have invented a better structure for telling a story.
Well, you have to wonder, it begs the question, what is any of us capable of doing if under the right amount of stress?
Passes for virtue in many cases is just lack of opportunity.
Right. Well, and then, you know, as you say, 25 years without a blemish on her career, right? How is somebody, it's just a fascinating, a lot of questions come up, you know, with the psychology. You know, how does somebody compartmentalize their life after something like that and go on?
But, you know, to me, the idea that, you know, she got away with it, for all the, and then suddenly on one day, she's called downstairs, and in this long conversation, she is confronted with who she is and what she's done. And what a fascinating, and here's the really cool thing. You don't even have to take my word for it as you read the story. You can go online and watch that interrogation. You can link to it. You can watch it yourself if you want.
Well, hey, since we're just talking here, have you seen that miniseries, The Staircase?
No.
About the woman who's killed by falling down the staircase, hitting the back of her head. Kind of a famous, really interesting story. If you had, I was going to pick your brain about it, but check it out. I'd be really anxious to hear what your take is on it.
Give me a couple of weeks and I'll take it in and I'll be happy to tell you what.
I'll send you an email. Finally, and then we'll kind of wrap it up. I want to ask you a little bit about Killing Pablo and what that was like to write, going into that world. And also, as kind of a corollary to that, did anything about the El Chapo, the more recent El Chapo kind of case, interest you? And have you done any writing about that case?
Well, that's a lot. Start with El Chapo.
Yeah.
To be honest, a few years ago, you may recall that El Chapo gave an interview to Sean Penn.
Yes.
That ran Rolling Stone magazine. Well, before that all happened, I got a call from a lawyer in Los Angeles who asked me if I would be interested in interviewing El Chapo.
Really?
At that time, fugitive from justice. And this happened because of Killing Pablo. I mean, I've known someone who's written about, drug cartels. So I talked to this lawyer and I said, yes, I would be interested in meeting El Chapo and interviewing him. But if I do that, I'm going to do my own reporting and I'm going to talk to a lot of other people and he's going to have no control over, what I write or what I think. I mean, that's just not how I work. And if he wants to arrange to talk to me under those circumstances, then yes, sign me up. Well, that was the last I heard from El Chapo's people, and they got Sean Penn to do it. And apparently, Sean Penn, who is a wonderful actor pretending to be a journalist, who basically gave them an opportunity to read the story before it was written and published. And it's just another black mark in Rolling Stone's declining recent years. So that was my El Chapo story. I missed the boat, I guess. The Killing Pablo story for me was just something that actually grew out of my reporting in Black Hawk Down. Because I've got to know these special operators who work for the United States military, Delta Force operators, they had been deeply involved in the hunt for Pablo Escobar. And I remember actually I was in the office of a high-ranking military officer who shall go unnamed, and we were talking about Somalia, and he had a photograph on his wall of a bloody dead fat man on a rooftop with a bunch of guys posing around him with rifles, like a big game hunt, you know, photograph. And it was so grotesque, I said, excuse me, you know, what is that? And he takes his cigar out of his mouth. He says, that, my friend, is Pablo Escobar. I keep that picture on my wall to remind me that no matter how rich you get in this life, you can still be too big for your britches. So I remember writing down on my notepad, Pablo Escobar, and underlining it, because I didn't know, you know, that the United States military had been involved with hunting down Pablo Escobar. So that led me on the thing I did right after Black Hawk Down, traveling to Colombia, you know, finding people who knew Pablo Escobar, getting to know Hugo Martinez, who just died a couple months ago, who was the head of the search block, and his son, who was the person who actually found Pablo Escobar. Just an amazing, amazing story, and one that to this day, I marvel that I wrote, because I'm like the least qualified person in the world to have written that story. I don't speak Spanish. I've never been to Colombia. There's a wonderful journalistic community in Colombia and great writers, you know, like Gabriel Garcia Marquez, for Christ's sake. I mean, Colombia is a vibrant journalistic literary culture, and yet no one had written this story. And to me, it is one of the most extraordinary stories of modern times. The seventh richest man in the world is hunted down to a rooftop and killed in Medellin, Colombia, after nearly bringing the government of Colombia to its knees. I mean, to me, you just can't make this stuff up.
Well, it's like you read that story and you think, wow, this is basically Shakespeare in a modern context. You know, some of these characters.
And there were sons and fathers and. Oh, it was so rich that I marvel at it. So one of the things that you can say when you write nonfiction is that a fucking great story? You know, I didn't make it up. It just is. It's just an amazing, amazing story.
Now, when did Killing Pablo come out? Was it in the late 90s?
I think it's 2001.
2001, okay.
I was in Morocco where we were shooting Black Hawk Down when I got the first hardcover copy of Killing Pablo, and I remember giving it to Ridley Scott, and I still tease him about it to this day. I said, Ridley, you're the one who had first dibs on Killing Pablo.
It's funny, there's another journalist, I'm sure he passed away a couple of years ago. I actually was fortunate enough to meet him a few times, a guy named Charles Bowden. Do you know his work?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I do.
I've read some of it. And I'm aware that he has a wonderful reputation, and he wrote about the Southwest, and, you know, the Texas, Arizona.
He wrote a lot about Ciudad Juarez and, you know, about the cartel. And he, mainly in Harper's, he published a lot of pieces in Harper's and did a number of really good books about that subject. Have you kind of kept up with, I mean, the cartels after, you know, into the modern period? I mean, it's gotten really, really, obviously very dark in the last 20 years.
Yeah. I'm on the board of an organization called the Logan Nonfiction Center up in New York. And they invite fellows every year who are working on book-length projects. And I go up and spend a week just meeting with these writers and, you know, hearing these incredible stories and giving them whatever advice I can give them. And we have a lot of Latino and Mexican writers who've taken part in that program, many of whom are writing about these terrible tragedies in Mexico and the violence there. And so it's through them really that I've been aware of it. I've not personally been, you know, working on these projects, but I know it's awful and very, very rich material.
Yeah, you know, so many of those, you know, getting back to what we were talking about earlier, you know, about the kind of the journalist's function in society, you know, you have to just stand in awe of some of those Mexican journalists, you know, who were just brutally murdered.
Without a doubt, very, very brave souls. You know, I'm so fortunate that I've always been working in America. People have often said to me, you know, have you ever been really afraid to write something? And the answer is no. I feel perfectly safe working and writing anything I want here in the United States. I wouldn't feel that safe if I lived in Mexico or Colombia. So I do think, and I do take part in organizations to try to support journalists around the world who are in these really difficult places, because I recognize how fortunate we are in this country and how much, you know, help they sometimes need.
Now, certainly you have some good stories for us of being stalked or threatened or anything.
No, you know, I'm a writer, not a fighter. I I've been to some hairy places, and yeah. I've been in situations that have been, you know, deeply uncomfortable, and I try my best to get out of them as fast as I can. So I'll tell you a story about, you know, being a reporter overseas. The real courageous journalists in many parts of the world are actually the photographers. And I was in the Middle East during the first Intifada in 1988, covering the Palestinian uprising for my newspaper. And I went to Ramallah, which is a city in the West Bank. And I was with a photographer named George Azar. And the reason I was with George is because I had no idea what I was doing. And George, who worked there a lot, knew where to find the action. So I said, you know, I'm just going to tag along with you, George. So we went to Ramallah, and we're standing out in the middle of the street. And every day, George is telling me this, the Shabab, the Palestinian youth, they get all riled up inside the mosque, and then they come charging out at like noon. And then up the street, you know, the Israeli Defense Forces would be waiting with tear gas and rubber bullets, and there would be this clash. And so George was there to capture this all on film. And I thought, well, hell, I'm writing about it, so I'll go with George. So I'm in the middle of the street. The Shabab come chanting out of the mosque, and they're coming right up the street toward us. And I turn around, and right behind me are the Israeli Defense Forces brandishing their rifles and their weapons. And I realize, shit, I'm right in the middle of this thing. And so I'm looking for, and the tear gas is starting to fly. So I took off, and as I'm running, I noticed George pulling a gas mask off of his belt and sticking on a gas mask. So I just headed to the highest, most distant place that I could find. There's the difference between being a writer and a photographer. I covered it from a safe distance.
Noted journalist Bowden went missing today, and yeah. Well,
I've been lucky to avoid.
Well, thanks for tolerating all my questions. I really appreciate you spending some time. It's been a lot of fun talking with you today, and we'll say goodbye to our Facebook audience, and then I'll pick your brain about guitars for a few minutes. But I just wanted to say once again, check out this book. It is a wonderful collection of stories, and thanks very much, everybody, for joining us today. Let me just turn off the camera real quick.